So this is the second of two lectures on exchange rates. Yesterday in the first lecture, we met the concept of a spot exchange rate and a forward exchange rate. We learned that the currency markets and the bond markets are intimately related. So if we're going to study exchange rates, we also have to think about interest rates. Interest rates and exchange rates are intimately related. I said to you that I wanted to introduce you to three or four key results. We met the first of those results towards the end of yesterday's lecture, interest rate parity. And whilst we can't go into it into too much detail, what I want you to know is that interest rate parity is a result that links a forward exchange rate to the corresponding spot exchange rate. Let me remind you, a spot exchange rate is the rate at which you can exchange two currencies today. You agree that rate today, and the transaction takes place today. Whereas a forward exchange rate is a rate you agree today, but which doesn't take place today. The transaction doesn't happen today, it happens at some point in the future. In the context of forward exchange rates, I mentioned currency forwards and currency futures. And these are two different sorts of instruments, contracts, that enable you to lock in a forward exchange rate. The key difference between currency forwards and currency futures is that currency forwards are traded over the counter. We refer to them as OTC contracts. That means the precise details are agreed between the two counterparties through the medium of a broker. An organised exchange is not involved, whereas currency futures are exchange-traded contracts. So whereas currency forwards are highly bespoke, they are tailored to the needs of the two counterparties, currency futures are standardised contracts. It's the exchange that has designed the features of the currency futures, and they've designed them because generally they meet most counterparties' needs, but not necessarily every individual. So I want you to understand that interest rate parity links the forward exchange rate to the corresponding spot exchange rate, and the relationship, which we finished with at the end of yesterday's lecture, is driven by the principle of no arbitrage. Now, we don't know in detail what arbitrage is. You have to wait until Finance 1 to understand it in more detail. But we do have some notion of being able to make profits from exploiting mispricing between similar assets or similar contracts. And that's exactly what's going on here. The no arbitrage principle is saying that two related strategies must result in the same value, must result in the same gain or loss, otherwise there's an opportunity to make money. There's an opportunity to make money without exposing yourself to any risk. If you look back at the diagram that we had on the last slide, the slide that we finished with yesterday, there are two legs of an arbitrage strategy here. One leg refers to borrowing a sum of money. In our example, we were borrowing £1 million for 1 year at the 1 year UK borrowing rate. That was one leg of the strategy. The other leg of the strategy involved three steps. We exchanged those pounds sterling for dollars, US dollars, at the going spot exchange rate, but we also locked ourselves into a forward exchange rate involving dollars and pounds to take us back in the opposite direction 1 year down the road. So there were two legs to that strategy, both of which that involved an exchange of currencies. There was also a lending the dollar equivalent for 1 year at the 1 year US lending rate. What I want you to see from the diagram is there's no risk. We're locking in the borrowing or lending rates, so there's no uncertainty about the interest rate, and the two exchange rate contracts that we're entering into, the two so-called foreign exchange deals, cancel each other out in terms of risk. Why? Because it's the same currency pairing, and we're agreeing not just the spot exchange rate that takes our initial pounds into dollars, we're also today locking in the corresponding forward rate that takes us back. There is no risk. So, absence of arbitrage would dictate that these two numbers in the bottom left-hand corner should be equal and opposite. We started the story with empty pockets, so this is a zero-cost investment strategy. We needed some capital in order to do something. That is why we borrowed the £1 million. We had nothing in our pockets to start with. We are not exposing ourselves to any interest rate risk or exchange rate risk. So we have no business to expect to end up with any profit in our pockets 1 year hence. That's the absence of arbitrage principle. We saw when we used the numbers that the two results were not quite equal and opposite, and I explained to you that that was because of a deficiency in the data. The exchange rates, the spot exchange rate and the forward exchange rate that I used, are so-called mid-rates. You cannot trade. You can't buy or sell currencies at mid-rates. Mid-rates are simply the average of the buying and selling rates, and we calculate those averages simply to enable us to list numbers in a table. We can't actually trade at these two exchange rates. So we would need to find the exchange rate that enables us to buy dollars with pounds. Likewise, the exchange rate, the forward exchange rate, that enables us 1 year from now to sell dollars for pounds. So we would need the bid or the offer rate, not the mid rate. And if I had those rates, those two numbers would have been equal and opposite. The currency markets are highly liquid. Arbitrage opportunities do not survive for any length of time. And the principle of no arbitrage is what leads to this result. I'd like to give you a way of remembering it. And you won't find this in any textbook that I know of. You won't find this in any academic paper that I've ever seen. Because I learnt this rule from the traders. I learnt this rule from the currency traders that I used to sit and observe when I worked for UBS. So what's the rule to help you remember the interest rate parity formula? The first thing you do is you ask yourself, what is the quoted currency? And the quoted currency is the currency of which there is one unit in the exchange rate quote. So, when I look at a quotation like this, this is telling me that I can exchange £1 for $1.5449 US cents. Pound sterling is the quoted currency because there's one unit of it in that quotation. The other currency is known as the counter currency. So in our example, pound sterling is the quoted currency, US dollar is the counter currency. On the left-hand side is the forward exchange rate. On the right-hand side is the spot exchange rate multiplied by the ratio of 1 plus an interest rate. The question is, which of the two interest rates appears upstairs, which appears downstairs? It's easy to remember. The interest rate in the country that goes with the quoted currency, here that's pound sterling, always appears downstairs. So in general, I could have written big R subscript quoted. The interest rate that appears upstairs is the interest rate in the country where the domestic currency is the counter currency. How is it I find it easy to remember this? Because I remember the phrase over the counter. So the counter currency goes upstairs or over the counter. I can't go wrong. Provided I'm clear about what is the quoted currency, the rest is plain sailing, because the interest rate that appears downstairs is the interest rate in the country which has the quoted currency. The interest rate that appears upstairs is the interest rate in the country that corresponds to the counter currency. Please note that the interest rates I'm talking about are nominal interest rates, not real interest rates. You have to think back to what we learned in the project appraisal lectures that linked nominal with real interest rates. These are nominal interest rates. The interest rate parity theorem links a forward exchange rate with a spot exchange rate, and both are known today. Forward exchange rates enable us to lock in an exchange rate for some point in the future. They are useful to parties, counterparties, who are worried about exposure to risk. You can lock in an exchange rate. You don't have to worry about the exchange rate moving in an unfavourable direction. So the interest rate parity theorem is driven by the motive of hedging. What lies behind the interest rate parity theorem is the notion, the motive, of hedging against risk. We're going to meet another result shortly that's driven not by hedging, but by speculation. And I want you to know the difference. Before I go any further, I want to take a pause, and I want to provide you with something that I promised yesterday. Because one of the things I said to you yesterday was I would show you where to get these interest rates from the newspaper. I think I had better deliver on that promise. You can all go to the Financial Times website, www.ft.com. So that's the home page of the Financial Times. Let's go to the market section along the top row, pull down the menu, and choose markets data. So now we're on the market data page. Look along this row until you get to data archive. Click on data archive. This is going to enable us to go backwards in time, wherever we want. Now, in the data that's in your handout, that refers to trading at the end of the day on the 23rd of February, 2010. So can I reproduce those tables? Let's go to currencies. Let's pick currency summary. And let's select a date. The data in your handout is February 2010. So I work my way back through the calendar until I get to February 2010. It was the 23rd of February. And so I click download. And what appears on the screen in a moment, I trust, should be a copy of the table that you've got in your handout. That's where I got it. So now you can get that table and any other relevant table at any point in the past. So I said to you that as an exercise, I wanted you to revisit the calculations. How about we do them using yesterday's data, 8th of March. So let me go back to March 2011. Let me choose the 8th of March. Let me download. And what should appear is the corresponding table for yesterday. I showed you where I took the numbers from the table that referred to the 23rd of February 2010. There's nothing stopping you now to do the same for the 8th of March 2011. Will it help you pass the class test? No. Will it help you pass the exam? No. So why should you bother doing it? Well, only if you're genuinely interested in the subject of finance. And in fact, maybe that's one way of testing whether you are genuinely interested. Not only can you open up any of these tables for currencies, and we had two. I had the currency summary. I also had exchange cross rates. You might also want to look at pound spot forward, because there are many more currencies listed against the pound. If the US dollar is your bag rather than the pound, then you would go up to dollar spot forward. But it's not just currencies that you can look at. There's also bonds and interest rates. And we looked at one in particular called international money market rates. It used to be called euro currency rates when I was in the city, but they now call it international money market rates. So here is the corresponding table for yesterday, 8th of March, for that table of interest rates that we looked at in the lecture. So there's absolutely nothing now to stop you updating those slides with current numbers, and I strongly recommend you do that, but it's your choice. So let's go back to the lecture. You can read the next slide on interest rate parity for yourself. I want to move on to the second result. I have a number of colleagues who are experts in international finance and FSX markets. And I have asked each and every one of them, more than once, is this really the name that we use for this result? Because it sure as hell is a mouthful. Do we really call this result the forward rate unbiased hypothesis? And they assure me there isn't any other way of labelling it. So it's ungainly. We have to use the same nomenclature. So what is the second result known as the forward rate unbiased hypothesis? It links the forward exchange rate with an expected future spot exchange rate. Now be careful. When we were talking about the interest rate parity theorem, the spot exchange rate was today's spot exchange rate. But in the forward rate unbiased hypothesis, the spot exchange rate is the spot exchange rate at some point in the future. And today we don't know what that is, so the best we can do is forecast it. And what the forward rate unbiased hypothesis is saying is, one possible forecast is today's forward exchange rate. So, if you know the one-year forward exchange rate, and you do, if you can be bothered to look up the newspaper or check the website of the exchange, the relevant trading exchange, so we do know forward exchange rates, e.g. the one-year forward exchange rate between the US dollar and the pound sterling, if what you'd really like to know is, what will the spot exchange rate between the pound and the US dollar be 1 year from now? Well, firstly, you have to accept you can't know that today because you don't have a crystal ball. The best you can do is forecast it, and one possible forecast is today's one-year forward rate. Now, what the forward rate unbiased hypothesis says is that forward exchange rate, which you know today, is an unbiased forecast. In other words, if you were to use it many times over and over again, roughly half the times you use it, it will overestimate the future spot rate, and roughly half the times it will underestimate. There is no intrinsic bias to overestimate or underestimate. And that's what that equation is saying. It would have been nice if I could have said to you, the best forecast of the expected future spot rate is today's forward rate. It would have been nice if I could have said that, but that is not necessarily true. All I can say is the forward rate is one number to look at in an attempt to forecast what the future spot exchange rate is. It isn't necessarily the best. Its strength is it doesn't suffer from any bias, but it may bring with it big error bars. The error may be large. On average, the error will neither be positive nor negative. You won't tend to overestimate or underestimate, but I cannot promise you that the degree by which you're out is small, because that is not true. So I want you to know that result. I want you to know that the forward exchange rate has a use as a predictive tool. It's one possible forecast for the future spot exchange rate. The spot exchange rate at some point in the future. Now we move on to the third result. I didn't list this on the earlier slide for a very good reason. Unlike the first two results, and indeed unlike the one that's still to come, they all involve exchange rates and interest rates, or as we'll see, inflation rates. But this one doesn't mention exchange rates. This one only talks in terms of interest rates. It's called Fisher's open proposition. And Fisher is Irvin Fisher. And he's the Fisher we met in the project appraisal lectures. So what you've got to be thinking back now in your mind is, what was Fisher's relation that we learned in project appraisal? So let me remind you. It's the same Fisher. Fisher gave us a relationship. Fisher gave us a relationship between a nominal interest rate, and I label that big R, and the corresponding real interest rate that I label little r. Now, real is a very shorthand way of saying adjusted for inflation. So what I need to remind you of is that the missing piece in Fisher's relation is the expected inflation rate, little I. And because in finance we're always looking into the future, it's an expected inflation rate. You have to know this relationship. We met it in the context of project appraisal. So big R is the nominal rate of interest, little r is the corresponding real rate of interest, or the rate of interest adjusted for inflation. And it may help you remember that if you rewrite Fisher's relation that way around, so that you can see what's happening is that the real rate of interest, little r, is less than the nominal rate of interest, big R, and it's the expected inflation rate that's causing that. In other words, money that you deposit in a bank account, that's a nominal sum of money, would grow at the nominal rate of interest. But what you're really interested in is what can you do with that money once you've taken it out of the bank. In other words, what is your purchasing power? Your purchasing power grows at the real rate of interest. So the expected inflation rate, as we saw in the lectures on project appraisal, slows down the rate at which your purchasing power grows. That's what the real rate of interest is measuring. At what rate is your purchasing power growing? So what is Fisher's open proposition then? Fisher's open proposition is as follows, and it's really quite simple. It's powerful, but it's simple to state. That number, little r, is the same in all countries. Different countries have different nominal rates of interest. Different countries have different expected rates of inflation. But in Fisher's proposition, all countries have the same real rate of interest. And you can read the slide for some of the justification. So that's our third result, that little r, the real rate of interest, is the same in all countries. Now let's try and bring together these different results, because I'm throwing a lot at you and you need time to assimilate it. I appreciate that. So let's go back to interest rate parity. So here is interest rate parity. We'll write it for the currency pair pound sterling US dollars, because that's the example that we had. But you know how to generalize that to any currency pair. I've given you the quick way of remembering which interest rate appears upstairs, which interest rate appears downstairs. In our quotation, pound sterling is the quoted currency. So the nominal rate of interest in the UK appears downstairs. Now I've got to tell you the truth. I forgot to say something. Well, I deliberately forgot to say something. This is known as covered interest rate parity. And you'll meet that term if you carry on with your studies of finance, and in particular, in your final year, you take the elective International Financial Management. You'll learn a lot about covered interest rate parity. And the word covered reminds us of two things. One, the motive is hedging. Hedging ourselves against exposure to risk. And two, the word covered reminds us that it's the forward exchange rate that appears on the left-hand side, and the forward exchange rate is something we know today and can lock into. That's how we hedge against risk. Currency risk. But now we have another result. Because now we have the forward rate unbiased hypothesis. Do you remember what that was? The forward rate unbiased hypothesis told us that we could equate the forward exchange rate with our forecast, our expected future spot rate. So that's the forward rate unbiased hypothesis. So now I get another result. It looks very similar to my first result, but there's one important difference. On the left-hand side, I no longer have a forward rate that I know today for sure. On the left-hand side, I now have a forecast of a future spot rate. This is another form of the interest parity theorem. This is the uncovered interest rate parity theorem. And you'll meet that if you go on and study international finance. So this is uncovered interest rate parity. Whereas covered interest rate parity is driven by motives of hedging, wanting to protect ourselves against exposure to risk. Here the risk is that the exchange rate might change in the future in a direction that's unfavourable to us. That's covered interest rate parity. In uncovered rate interest rate parity, the motive isn't hedging, the motive is speculation. Because we're trying to forecast a future spot exchange rate in order to make money. We're going to put on some position involving different currencies in an attempt to make an arbitrage profit on the strength of our forecast. If our forecast turns out to be right, we're quids in. We're in the money. If our forecast turns out to be wrong, we could lose serious amounts of money. So there are, in fact, two forms of the interest rate parity theorem. The covered interest rate parity theorem, which is the one you usually meet first, is driven by considerations of hedging and has the forward exchange rate on the left-hand side. That's a number you know today for sure. The uncovered interest rate parity theorem is driven by motives of speculation, and it has on the left-hand side the expected future spot exchange rate. So it's a forecast. It may or may not be correct. So now we're ready for the fourth and final result. And at this point, I need to remind you of something I said yesterday, but haven't said so far, about interest rate parity. We believe interest rate parity works well in the short term. So we have a high level of confidence in that result in the short term. Do we have a corresponding result for the long term? And the answer is yes. It's called purchasing power parity. And that's the final result that I want us to move on and talk about now. Again, as I did yesterday, I want to pause. This is another opportunity for you to look at the slide and criticise me. Because again, the slide would appear to be informed by data from a year or more ago. The numbers in this table have been taken from an article that appeared in The Economist back on the 16th of July 2009. So that's more than 18 months ago. How lazy of me. The Economist publishes an article every so often, every 6 to 9 months, about something it calls its Big Mac Index. And I want to introduce you to The Economist's Big Mac Index. As you've probably worked out, the reason I've left the numbers on this slide to be the numbers I took from the 16th of July 2009 article is I want you to go and find a more recent article from The Economist and redo the numbers. So let's just make sure we know how to get that. Of course, I will upload that article for you onto my.wbs, but it would be good if you knew where to get it for yourself in the first place. So let's go to the website of The Economist magazine. So here is the homepage of The Economist, and what I'm interested in is the Big Mac Index. So I enter that as my search string, because I don't know where to find it. I can't be bothered browsing. Life's too short. So it comes up with this page, and it's on to me. It's trying to help me. Are you looking for our Big Mac Index? Yes, I am. Thank you very much. So here is the list of the most recent articles that are featured in The Economist. In fact, if you scroll all the way down, you'll find all the articles that have ever appeared in The Economist, going back, I think, to 1996, when they first created this so-called Big Mac Index. The numbers in my slide are taken from this article. Now, some of the articles that are listed there are brief, and they don't have all the data that you need. So I haven't been quite as lazy as it might appear. So we better have a look to see what is there in The Economist. I went back to July 2009. There's a fair bet that the article in July 2010 has what I want. Well, that looks relevant, but not quite what I'm after. This is what I'm after. Now, you won't find that table in each of those past articles, so you have to check. I think you'll find that the most recent one is July 2010. So my invitation to you is to find the corresponding numbers that I extracted from the July 2009 article in order to update your slide. You can now do that for yourself. So what are these numbers in this table that I've taken from The Economist? Well, it's a sample, so I've picked some of the biggest economic areas or countries: the UK, the US, the Euro area, and Japan. And here are the exchange rates. So these were the market exchange rates, and it gives you the date. So at the end of trading on the 13th of July 2009, these were the spot exchange rates. So £1 would have bought you $1.61 US cents. Normally we would quote the exchange rate to four decimals, but there isn't enough space in The Economist newsprint for that, so we've rounded it to two. So here are the spot exchange rates. In the next column in the table are the local prices of a Big Mac. What would it cost you then, in mid-July 2009, to buy a hamburger if you were in the US? It would have cost you $3.57. What would a same hamburger have cost you in the UK? £2.29. You get the idea. Now, the underlying principle is, when referred to a common currency, this hamburger should cost the same amount. US citizens shouldn't be paying over the odds Japanese citizens shouldn't be paying over the odds, nor should they be able to buy on the cheap. Is that true? If that's exactly true, then we have purchasing power parity. If it's not exactly true, then purchasing power parity is being violated to some degree. Let's see what the data suggests. Using each of these exchange rates, I'm converting, in this table, I'm converting these local prices into a common currency, and I'm following the example of the economist, I'm converting the price of the Big Mac into US dollars. So you see immediately what's going on. Once I've done that, I see at a glance that a Big Mac is relatively expensive in the euro area, because inhabitants of the euro area countries are typically paying the equivalent of $4.60 for their Big Mac, whereas someone in Japan is getting away with the equivalent of $3.46. So the Big Mac, as an example of something to purchase, an example of something that lots of people, it would appear, want to purchase, the Big Mac pricing in the different countries is not in line with purchasing power parity. In the next column is a useful number called the price relative. So that's simply how much does the Big Mac cost in each country, the UK, in the euro area, in Japan, relative to what it costs in the US. Having expressed the price of the Big Mac in the common currency, namely the US dollar, I can quickly work out those ratios. If purchasing power parity held, if it held in its absolute form, each of these ratios should be 1. The extent to which they're not 1 is pointing up some deviation from what we call absolute purchasing power parity. There's one other piece of information I can extract. I can work out the exchange rate implied by the price of the Big Mac. Now let's be clear. The numbers in this column, they are the market spot exchange rates. They are the actual spot exchange rates. But were we to use the Big Mac as an instrument of barter, as in some sense an instrument of exchange, the currency, the exchange rates implied by the local prices of the Big Mac would be these. So that's this final piece of information. So what is it I want you to know? Just as interest rate parity comes in two forms, covered and uncovered, so does purchasing power parity come in two strengths. The stronger form of purchasing power parity is absolute, PPP, purchasing power parity. And absolute purchasing power parity would say all of these price relatives should be one and remain one. There is a gentler form of purchasing power parity called relative PPP, purchasing power parity. Relative purchasing power parity says, look, not all of these numbers need equal one. They could be different from one, but they mustn't change through time. So relative purchasing power parity allows for the possibility that at some point in time, the prices of the same good in different countries are out of line, but they don't move further out of line. They don't move into alignment. They don't move away from alignment. The ratio stays put. So whereas absolute purchasing power parity insists on the precise value of 1.00 in each entry in this column, and it must stay at 1.00, relative purchasing power parity says it's okay for the numbers to be different from one another, but none of the numbers itself must change through time. So the ratio must stay fixed. And there's some justification on the slide for that, why that should be. What I want to leave you with is the equation that describes purchasing power parity. I want you to notice the two key features. On the left-hand side is the expected future spot rate. On the right-hand side, we no longer have the nominal interest rates, as we did in the interest rate parity theorem. Now we have the expected inflation rates. Now you could, and maybe you should do this as an exercise. If you started with uncovered interest rate parity. If you started with that relationship, and then you incorporated it with Fisher's open principle, Fisher's open proposition, you should be able to convince yourself that thanks to Fisher's open proposition, this ratio simplifies. Let's check. Remember, Fisher's result. 1 plus the nominal rate equals 1 plus the real rate times 1 plus the expected rate of inflation. That's true in the US. That's true in the UK. Divide the first one by the second one. And then remind ourselves, what did Fisher tell us in his open proposition? He told us that the real rates of interest were the same in all countries. So 1 plus little r, 1 plus little r, 1 plus little r cancels upstairs and downstairs. Do you see that what I emerge with is what's on the right-hand side of the type slide? So I started with uncovered interest rate parity. I drew your attention to this factor on the right-hand side of the uncovered interest rate parity result. I expanded it thanks to Fisher's relation. That's upstairs and downstairs. But Fisher's open proposition that we met earlier in this lecture tells me that the real rate of interest in both countries is the same. That's the assumption. So this factor cancels. And what I'm left with on the right-hand side, multiplying the spot exchange rate, is the ratio of the two inflation rates. So what's the message behind purchasing power parity? The message is the following. If the inflation rates, if the expected inflation rates in the two countries are different, it sounds like the residents in one country are going to end up paying, in relative terms, less than the residents in another country. It doesn't work that way, however, because where the expected inflation rates are different in the two countries, the exchange rate is expected to change, and it changes in exactly the direction that cancels the effect of the differential inflation rates. So if it were the case, for instance, that the inflation rate in the US was greater than the inflation rate in the UK, at first sight, that would suggest to us that US residents are going to end up paying more still for their hamburger. But when we compare what the US citizens are paying with what the UK citizens are paying, we have to correct for the currency. We have to express the price of the hamburger in a common currency, let's say the US dollar. So we need to know the exchange rate. The exchange rate changes. The exchange rate changes in exactly the way that's needed to cancel out the effect that comes about because the inflation rate is higher in the US. If the inflation rate in the US is higher than in the UK, the expected spot exchange rate goes up. That means you can buy more US dollars for every pound. And that exactly wipes out the effect of the increase in the price of the hamburger in the US. Our UK citizen isn't going to pay any more for his hamburger, whether he buys it in the UK or the US. It looks as if it's going to cost more in the US because the US price is going up faster than in the UK, but our UK citizen can exchange his pounds for more dollars. How many more dollars? Just enough more dollars to offset the increase in the price of the hamburger in the US. And that's what that result is saying. It's saying that exchange rates move in a direction to annul any differential in the inflation rates of the two countries. And that's what keeps the prices of the same good in line in those two countries. And that's where we'll leave it.